All right, let me say a few words about this time question, and then we can discuss and have questions and so forth. In the monograph, I discussed four ways in which the Hebrew word yom is used in the Old Testament. In some cases, it refers merely to a period of light, and we refer to it in that way. You know, is it day? Meaning, is it light? Is it daytime? We refer to daytime and nighttime, and day is when it's light and night's when it's dark. We even say night comes more quickly during the winter and leaves less quickly in the morning. The second one is 24-hour days, and actually, although the first time I heard this, it struck me as odd. What we do is we take a day and we divide it into 24 equal periods. That's what we really do. Somehow I got the idea that 24 hours was the basic unit, when actually the day is the unit, and we divide that into 24 equal periods. It's curious, but it's a change of focus, change of direction. The third meaning has to do with a definite bounded period, which could be either long or short, but it has definite boundaries, a day. The fourth meaning is an indefinite period without definite boundaries, a beginning and an end, a terminus ad quo and a terminus ad quem. There are no termini on this period. It's an indefinite period, and it can be short or long, but it's just the idea of the difference between definite, bounded, and indefinite, no bounds on it. So those are the four basic uses of the word yom in Scripture. And the question, of course, is which use is being employed here in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2? Of course, it's very crucial how we understand this yom concept if we're going to build a lot of stuff on it. And a lot of people build a lot of stuff on that concept. They build whole structures, superstructures. I've suggested in this proposal in the monograph on page 32, and I'd like to use that to focus my remarks. I've suggested instead of a conception like this, instead of seven successive 24-hour periods in immediate succession, one immediately following the other. Instead of seven successive 24-hour periods, and instead of seven long periods, definite periods, bounded periods, sometimes called day age or eons. Instead of seven definitely bounded periods, as what Genesis is referring to in terms of creative days and then the seventh day of rest, I've suggested here a much more complicated concept. I've suggested that God created original energy, which then took the form of matter, and then God created our universe, that is, in terms of its structure, and within that, our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. And that was all part of creative aspect period one. Creative aspect period is a period during which one aspect of God's creative activity takes place. One aspect. Looking at creation from different points of view, from different aspects. So this is talking about matter and the universe and our galaxy, that aspect. And then in creative aspect period two, I've located the creation of our solar system, the sun and its planets, planet Earth, and its satellite, the moon. And I've located day one, and it was evening and it was morning, day one, or first day. I've suggested that that day was a literal day, a 24-hour period. Now, that period, creative aspect period number two, as soon as the solar system is sufficiently in place, that is, structure-wise, and operating, so that the Earth is going around the sun once a year, so that the Earth rotating on its own axis rotates once a day, so that the same point on the Earth comes around to face the sun again in one day, what we call a day. And of course the moon going around maybe every 28 days around the Earth. I've suggested that as soon as that's in place, you've got literal days. As soon as the solar system is substantially in place, and the Earth is turning on its axis so that there's light-dark alternation. And that, therefore, you've got a number of days before day one, a number of literal days before day one. Because I've suggested that day one is not the first literal day, but that day one is a day when God looks upon his creative activity in that aspect, the creation of the solar system, and pronounces his work good, good in the horizon of his purpose, of his plan, what he intends. Good in that sense. Not that he did a good job, you know, patted himself on the back, said, you did well. But good in the sense of that horizon of his purpose, that concept of good. Therefore, that once the solar system is in place, once the Earth's going around the sun, once the Earth is turning on its own axis, you've got literal days. You've got light, darkness, alternations. And that you come to one literal day, and that's a point of substantial completion of God's creative command, or fiat, in which he said, let there be, let there be. So I suggest that there's a beginning point in this creative aspect period, which marks the beginning there, that slash in creative aspect period two, marks the beginning when God said, let there be this particular aspect. And then you come after a number of literal days to one special day when God looks on his work and says, it's good. Now you can have literal days after that, as you have in some of these creative aspect periods. But you have this one specific literal day in which he looks on his work and says, it's good in relation to my purpose. Now, the same thing is true in creative aspect period three. There's a beginning point. There's a point of substantial fulfillment or completion. And that's marked by day two. God looks upon his work, says, that's good. The atmosphere, the parting of the waters above the earth, the waters on the earth, atmosphere. Creative aspect period four, the appearance of the dry land. I mean, the land is there. It's under the water on that covers the earth. But now this involves all kinds of processes as far as the raising of continental masses and mountains, orogeny, all sorts of things that go on to bring the dry land above the water. Because, as you know, there's a lot of water on the earth, an awful lot. And you've got to raise land masses to get the land out of the water. I mean, the oceans have an average depth of, what, 14,000 feet, something like that? It's very deep. And also plants. And I suggest that day three is a day, a literal day, in which there is substantial completion of God's creative activity in regard to plants, the bringing forth of land plants. He looks on his work and says it's good. And then following that, there continues to be creation of various, now here I bring in the concept of kinds, mean, various kinds of plants. So God creates various kinds of plants. There's a point at which he sees that the work is substantially completed. He pronounces it good, and then he continues to produce, to create various kinds of plants. Creative aspect period number 5, the appearance of the light bearers. Appearance is the word. That's the key word. So now, it's not that the sun and the moon and the stars are created, but that they appear from the surface of the earth for the first time. So the appearance is what is created. God creates such a set of circumstances that from the surface of earth you can see now the sun, moon, and stars, and they can serve distinct purposes meteorologically. Creative aspect period 6, creation of aquatic animals and birds. Again, a day of essential fulfillment, day 5. Creative aspect period 7, again, each aspect period is a creative period during which some aspect of his creative work takes place. Terrestrial animals, the Garden of Eden, man and woman, and you come to day 6. I suggest then that that ceases God's creative activity in the ex nihilo and immediate senses. And so day 7 begins. And you will notice that day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are in that order, successive order. They follow one another. Now, they may be separated by many, 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 many days between. But these are special days on which God looks at his creative work in this particular aspect and pronounces it good. Again, I need to stress that once the solar system is in place, you've got days going on. You've got the earth and its relationship to the sun, and you've got light-darkness alternation, just as you have in the record. It was light, it was darkness, it was evening, it was morning, day 1. It was evening and it was morning, day 2. And that's all set up by the relationship of earth to sun, revolution around the sun, and rotation on its own axis. Then, at the bottom of that, I've attempted a correlation, a very coarse general correlation with geology and paleontology, taking the categories Precambrian, Paleozoic, Mesozoic, Cenozoic. At the bottom there, it has a C in the Paleozoic. That's supposed to be representative of Cambrian, the Cambrian period of the Paleozoic era. And then S is supposed to represent the Silurian period of the Paleozoic era. And then the J in the Mesozoic is supposed to represent the Jurassic period of the Mesozoic era. And then the Q under Cenozoic is supposed to represent the Quaternary period of the Cenozoic era. Did I supply you with the standard relative time scale on the next page? Well, there are all those names. Okay, all the names are there as far as spelling and order of the periods and so forth. It's a little confusing because of the way that the naming system developed. It's not really uniform or consistent. That's a little unfortunate. But that's what those letters and names represent in the geologic and paleontologic record. And then I've brought the days down from above where there are different aspects. I've brought down the days and put them on that timeline, that geological paleontological timeline, as to where those days come on that timeline. Two questions, Brian and then Sunman, okay?
I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying.
Yes, that's what I want.
Okay. Like, for instance, day 3, you're saying that on day 3 he begins to create dry land and plants, and with that, and then he continues to do so during the period of time?
Okay. My suggestion is there are three stages in each creative aspect period. Sometimes the second and the third stage virtually coincide time-wise, but there are three stages. First is the initial stage when God says, let there be. Then, secondly, there's a stage of essential fulfillment of this command. It's that stage of essential fulfillment that I'm identifying with these literal 24-hour periods, these days. And then there's a third stage of completion. So this creative fiat, this initial stage, this stage of essential fulfillment, and this stage of completion. And that's true in each of the creative aspect periods. I'm identifying, time-wise, the days, the literal days, day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, with the stage of essential fulfillment in each of these creative aspect periods. So that means that after God said, let there be, various kinds of that, or if we're talking about animals and plants, various kinds of animals and plants are created, and then at a certain point, he looks upon the work that he's done, pronounces it good. Essentially, he's got everything there that he needs for the purpose that is good for that horizon. But then he may continue to create various other kinds of plants, various other kinds of aquatic animals and birds, right on up until the end of day 6, where ex nihilo and immediate creation ceases. Sun Man.
How is the galaxy related to the solar system? Is it possible for galaxies, to exist independent from the solar system?
Well, ours. Yes.
The related question would be. There is a theological meaning of the host beyond as indefinite enough. So how do they claim this on what they
see all four meanings of Yom are used in scripture. So you could say, well, you know, any one of these I could select and make up some sort of a construct. These refer to long periods. Okay? I have a problem with long periods, day age, because it doesn't seem to fit the geological paleontologic record. It doesn't appear that certain things are created, then it comes to an end, and then certain things are created, and it comes to an end. Certain, some things go right on through the periods, and that seems to fit this construct better than that construct. Although you could take any one of the four and develop a construct from it, and the four meanings of Yom. That's why I suggest that day one comes at the end of that creative aspect period when the solar system is created. At the end of that period, this literal day one takes place. Now, that could mean that there could be many days while the solar system was coalescing, forming, being created by God in its present state. There could be many literal days before that, but certainly at the end of that creative aspect period, you can talk about a literal day. Darkness and light, alternation, evening and morning, and so forth. Once the solar system is in place. Now, as far as galaxy solar system, our solar system, that is, our sun, which is a star, and the planets that go around our sun, our star, are part of the Milky Way galaxy. Now, you see, what you have to do is you have to look at these creative aspect periods, some of them as overlapping in time. What I've done is, at the bottom line, I've brought them all together on one timeline. But at the top, where they're divided, you're looking at God's creative activity from different aspects, different points of view. And some of those may overlap in time. So that our galaxy, you notice, and the solar system our galaxy and the solar system are, as far as time, considerably overlapping on the chart, on the diagram. Okay? Rick. Oh, yes. Good.
So we can assume our solar system already was there when the galaxy was created.
Certainly that's part of the formation, the completion of the formation of our galaxy. Stars with satellites, planets. Now, this happens to be a very special star and very special planets, and our Earth happens to be a very special planet. Yeah. Rick.
Okay. God creates the seed-bearing planet. God saw it was good. There was evening, there was morning the third day. Then there's lights, and he makes the lights and the stars. And then there's evening and morning the fourth day. So we're saying that.
I suggest that the.
1.4 hours.
I suggest the appearance of the light bearers, sun, moon, and stars, not the creation of them. They're created way back in pre-day one and in the creation of our galaxy and the solar system.
So when the appearance here, although, and I don't know what the original says, but it says in the NIV, God made two great lights, greater light to govern the day and lesser to govern the night.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, this whole period, we're saying like from the third day, there's evening, there's morning the third day. Then all this other happens, evening, morning the fourth day. So from all that, it's not a one literal 24-hour period.
What isn't a literal?
From the third day to the fourth day.
You mean, does the fourth day immediately follow the third day? My suggestion is no. That's my suggestion. By the way, in the Hebrew, the perfect and the pluperfect are expressed by the same form, so that you can read, God had made two great lights. Exactly. And there are other places where that's very important, where the account goes along, and then suddenly it seems to jump. But with the pluperfect, you understand. See, we have a pluperfect in English. In the Hebrew, you express it with the same form, perfect and pluperfect. And some of the accounts, unless you use the pluperfect, you can make a mishmash of the text. Okay? Jackie, did you have a point? No? Ray hit. And then Stephen? Thank you. Ray.
I kind of feel as though we're taking the categories that we know from science and reading it back into Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what I mean by that is when it says in verse 3, God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God, so and so on. So the evening and the morning of the first day.
Mm-hmm.
Now it seems to me we can take that as saying that the evening is the beginning of this period of time, and the morning is its end, sort of like the flower comes up in the evening and withers in the morning,
mm-hmm.
as in Proverbs.
Yes.
So we have a self-contained unit here, from the starting with let there be, and then the summary of it, the evening and the morning.
Mm-hmm.
This is, in other words, I'm telling you the beginning and the end of it,
mm-hmm.
and then on. Now, in retrospect, we look back with these categories and say, well, in reality, it seems as though, like your chart says here, there's an overlap. Because of the geologic record.
Overlap
between these periods. In other words, we have...
But not of an overlap between the days.
Yes, overlap between the days, which begin with the evening and the morning.
But there's no overlap in these days.
In the text.
Excuse me, in the chart, there are no overlaps in the days.
Oh, I see. Okay, what I'm saying is that, yes, as you have these days here, but I'm looking at this whole period as a day, that it starts here, let there be, and then at the end of that, there's a summary that says, so the evening and the morning, the first day. Then we go to the second day.
Don't confuse creative aspect period one with the first day. I'm suggesting that's pre-day one.
You're talking about verse 1 and 2.
Exactly.
Okay, well,
yes.
Excluding that.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes.
Excluding that, but starting with verse 3.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And then it ends with, so the evening and the morning were the first.
Okay, that's what I'm looking at in creative aspect period two.
Yeah.
Okay?
And I would say that it seems that the creative aspect is a day. That is the first day. Because it says the first day. So that whole verse 3 and 5, 3 to 5, are the speaking of what happened in that first day.
Yes.
Which is an indefinite period of time.
Yes. But you're right. What I'm trying to do is put together what we know from general revelation as understood through scientific efforts and what we know from scripture. I'm trying to put those together. And if you take this lower scenario that each of these is a long period and it ends and it was evening and then it begins, the next one begins and it was morning, that doesn't work out with the general revelation. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, that's fine. Right,
yeah, that's my suggestion.
What I'm suggesting is that since Moses didn't know that, and God, you know, he wasn't going to try to say, well, this is what happened, but let me qualify it. What we have is we have a lump. We have one day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? These days do not have to come next to each other. In other words, one day, the end. And right after that, the second day. End. Right after that, the third day. What we have is a period of time that can overlap or not overlap any of these other days,
mm-hmm.
but it itself is self-contained for the sake of this narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my chart shows that too.
Okay, but aren't you, you're saying that evening and the morning refer to that one little dot that it, then you represent as the day one and day two?
It depends, of course, on whether you take evening, morning, alternation, light, darkness, alternation, as referring to a 24-hour period. It depends where you start the 24-hour period. If you start it in the evening, for instance, a day in Jewish reckoning would start with the evening, and then would go to the next evening. And then another day starts with evening, go to the next evening. So if you take it that way, then you don't have to stress evening and morning and make morning a narrower concept than the next period of light. You could take it as a full 24-hour period. And I'm suggesting we do that.
I mean, I was thinking that it wasn't that all.
Yeah. Stephen.
I have a question about something you haven't really addressed too much, and that's just accepting, like, it seems as though you accept the dating methods and everything that are used on the science, and which I've heard a lot of people like challenging in terms of really, you know, science's ability, man's ability to really accurately date things, the fossils and those different things, because they're based on assumptions and hypotheses that you really can't prove. I mean, the things that they just kind of assume for the purpose of the model or whatever. And I can't really explain it scientifically. But you've obviously gone through this. You pretty much accept the methods that they use to determine the age of.
I think if I were to state it in a scientific fashion, I would say I accept it at the present time. Science is always open-ended. One can always learn something which overthrows something previously, quote, established. So I would say that, yes.
So, okay, just for my own sake, am I correct then in assuming that as far as the methods that they do use to date the fossils, it is that in itself is an assumption, or it contains assumptions that have not been proven, as far as that.
The word proven there is a tricky word, because when you look into the past, it's hard to prove things in terms of extrapolation. The word prove there becomes very tenuous.
I think, I guess the part about it that I'm struggling with, because I had a course, a science course in college,
mm-hmm.
and talking about, I guess, carbon 14,
mm-hmm.
and this was like, 8 years ago, so it's a little hard for me to remember exactly what it was, but from what I remember, it was like the whole concept is based on an assumption of how much carbon there was in the beginning of the world or something like that. Help me with that if you can explain that a little bit. I remember at the time thinking, well, how did they know that?
Mm-hmm.
how do they know how much carbon 14 existed at the beginning of the universe?
It doesn't depend on how much carbon there was at the beginning of the universe. It only depends on how much carbon you have in a sample, any given sample. When they wanted to test the age of the Shroud of Turin, they were finally allowed a little piece, just a little piece, enough to make a test. And the whole question is not how much total amount. The question is, what's the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 in your sample? Carbon-12 occurring naturally, carbon-14 being an isotope which is created over time by various factors, and you have to measure the amount of carbon-14 to the amount of carbon-12, and it can be a very small sample. And there are very accurate ways of measuring, very accurate ways of measuring samples. So what you do is then you look at it and you ask the question, how long are we talking about in terms of a yardstick? How long does it take for radioactive carbon, carbon-14, to develop out of a sample of carbon that's bombarded, say, with cosmic rays? How long does it take for that to occur? Naturally occurring carbon-12 to turn to carbon-14. And so what you have to do is ask, what's the ratio of this? Okay? But carbon-14 is not really an issue. Carbon-14 is a very short yardstick, very short yardstick. And it's been recalibrated, very recently it's been recalibrated again. There are ways of checking carbon-14, but it's a very short yardstick. It doesn't take you back very far, geologically speaking. Okay? You're talking thousands of years with carbon-14. The radioactive methods, the ones that are very frequently mentioned, uranium, potassium, strontium, the various radioactive methods, thorium, they're long yardsticks. There we're talking about millions of years, not about a few thousand years. And it's those yardsticks, the long yardsticks, that are used when we're talking about the age of the Earth, the age of the solar system, the age of the galaxy, the age of the universe. Okay? That's what we're talking about there. And again, we're talking about the question of radioactive decay, measuring parent and daughter elements and the ratio between them. That's what we're really talking about. And again, very accurate ways of measuring the breakdown or disintegration of radioactive materials into lead or some other non-radiogenic material. So it's not really, again, a total amount. It's how much you have in your sample. Can you weigh that? Can you measure that? Yes, you can. And establish a ratio. The question, of course, is how long does it take to break down? How long does it take to disintegrate? Now you're talking about so many atoms firing off within a certain period of time. And you extrapolate back in terms of the total sample. And you ask, how long would it have taken for this particular sample to arrive at this particular state, given so many atoms firing off within a certain period of time? That's the way it works. Now, one can say, wait a minute, maybe we can change the rate of radioactive disintegration. Well, what they do is they try to change it. They try to change it, for instance, in the laboratory by subjecting radioactive materials to very, very high pressure. Very great changes of temperature, cold, pressure and cold, pressure and heat together, all kinds of they try to bombard it with other things. And it's very interesting. Cosmic ray bombardment is considered even into the equation. What does it do? And the curious thing is that just as often as anything that comes in, like cosmic rays, anything that comes in and bombards a sample, probability is that it bombards the parents as well as the daughters. And if it bombards both, then the net result is that it's virtually unchanged as far as rate of decay. They haven't been able to materially change the rate of decay of naturally occurring radioactive materials under all sorts of conditions known on Earth. The only thing that probably would do it is if the sun exploded. If the sun exploded, that might change the rate of decay. But we are talking about long yardsticks here.
I think that's the point where a lot of people have a hard time making the transition. I mean, as soon as you start suggesting that maybe the Earth really is billions of years old,
mm-hmm.
the red flags.
Oh, yes. I understand that. I was in that position myself. I understand that perfectly. And you know, this chart here on page 32 isn't tied to millions of years or billions of years or hundreds of thousands of years. It can operate at different levels. I mean, it's not tied to a specific amount in terms of years. The relative geologic time scale is a relative scale. You only are able to date the various periods by some independent yardstick. You can only say they come in this order, this sequence, but that doesn't really tell you about absolute time. Okay? For absolute time, you need a yardstick of some sort. Bart had some questions.
You classified these various creative periods as media within the media. In other words, as deploying secondary carbon and not employing secondary carbon.
Pages 31 and 32, thank you.
And I was wondering by what criteria...
33, I mean.
Okay. You have... well, it starts on 31 and finishes on 33.
Right.
I was wondering, looking at these, I'm wondering by what criteria, whether there is in the scripture, I can sort of see where you're coming from a natural... general revelation perspective.
Yes.
But in terms of the scripture, is there any way to deduce these categories?
Well, let's go through them very quickly. Let's go through the creative events as they're numbered. That's easy to refer to. I don't think there's any question on number one. Okay, ex nihilo creation of matter energy. Second, media creation, we could argue about that one in terms of a immediate creation, God using this matter energy and immediately creating the structured universe. That's arguable, okay? As far as the third one, that's also arguable. As far as the fourth one, that's also arguable. The fifth one, that I think there's more of a basis, not from scripture, but from what we know about the Earth's primitive atmosphere and the development of free oxygen and so forth, that concept, and how it relates to water vapor and so on. The sixth one, that could be argued in terms of creation of dry land. The seventh one, I think that's straightforward, immediate creation, God using previously existing materials. The eighth one, again, that relates to number five, the development of free oxygen coming to the point at which cloud cover breaks up and appearance is made manifest. Number nine, again, that's straightforward, immediate creation, and aquatic animals and birds. Number 10, see, we've already established that these animals and birds are made from the ground in that previous...
I have no problem with source
of
material.
Okay, good. Yes. Well, here, there are no secondary causes in immediate creation.
I understand.
Yes. So So it has to do all with media creation, those elements, right?
Yes, brief observation was that you seem to apply the term, whatever animate objects are in question, you seem to apply the term media.
Yes.
Whatever inanimate objects are in question, you seem to apply the term media, suggesting that there are secondary causes with inanimate objects, but not with animate objects. I'm just wondering.
There was no intention in that direction. That is not the way I broke it down.
Okay.
Yeah. No intention whatsoever there. That if that forms a pattern, purely unintentional. Yes. I took each event on its own merits.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying, and it just seemed to fall out in that regard. And I was just wondering if you had an additional part to your definition of immediacy, that I was sort of missing there, in the way in which you did.
Immediate and mediate.
Yeah.
The crucial difference is, as you suggested, the use of secondary causality.
Right.
That's the crucial difference.
There was some mention of the term vara and some other terms for create.
Yes.
And I didn't know if there was a consistency in this pattern, okay, in terms of the Hebrew.
Yeah.
That would have led you to, from a scriptural perspective,
no.
To draw
the truth. No. The three terms, vara, yatsar, and chasa, those three terms are all used for creation. Sometimes bara is made a technical term, which it is said always refers to creation ex nihilo, creation from nothing. That cannot be established by the usage of bara in scripture. And all that one needs to do, if one has a little knowledge, enough to be dangerous, one can look at bara in, say, Englishman's Hebrew concordance and look at its uses and ask, is this always ex nihilo creation? And find immediately it's disproven by scriptural usage. There's a very helpful article in the Theological Wordbook of the Old Testament by Harris, Archer, and Wolke on bara. And it's awfully interesting to look at that and see what they have to say. It's a brief article. It's not long. Theological Wordbook of the Old Testament. TWOT. Okay? It would be helpful to look at that article under bara. And they have it in English letters so you can understand bara. You don't have to know the Hebrew to look it up, okay? So that would be helpful. Another question. Bart has a couple of questions, so he's being gracious. Anybody else wants to get a question in edgewise here? Although the time has gone. But why don't we do this? If you have questions, don't lose them. Bring them next time. Next time we're scheduled to talk about the creation of man. That's an absolutely fascinating area. And let's bring in some of these questions. I'm sure they'll come up anyway, because the two are somewhat interrelated. All right? This looks like a very ambitious project.
Yeah, it rivals the human genome project.
Yeah, yeah. It's certainly needed.
That's true.
It's certainly needed.
Anybody might find it interesting in light of your article and some
yes.
Of the other things that came up.
Thank you.
Is that the indoor thing? Oh, okay.
This is the ink part of
the other thing. Okay. Did you see they're building an indoor, like a whole another world out in Arizona?
No.
It's 3 acres, and it's totally, they've elected 8 people to live inside of it. They're going to live in there for 2 years, and it's all privately funded. It has an ocean in it, and for 2 years.
Total artificial environment.
Yep.
If you run across it, you can cut it out for me. I appreciate things like that.
Yeah, it was, as a matter of fact, it was on the news today, but I saw it in USA Today about a month or so ago.
Oh, okay.
I can run across it again.
Yeah, and if you give me the reference, I appreciate it.
It was really something, a lot of money.
I'll bet. Well, of course, that could be a precursor, Brian, to the space platform.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah,
so
of course, to see you take another step.
Right.
You have to take little steps in science.
It's like Star Trek.
Pardon? Star Trek?
Yeah,
my wife, she hopes that happens. She wants to go up in a spaceship.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they feel if these people can survive, they can take this up to Mars.
Oh, yeah, and, they've been doing experiments for the last several years with sensory deprivation, especially underground in sort of containers, see if people can stand it for a number of months. That's also in preparation for this step, going to a space platform.
They're really serious about it.
Yeah,
they're serious about it. Now, with the possible decline of the threat of nuclear destruction from communism, the possible decline, it may be that Congress's funding will be undercut for some of these projects, and that I'm sure the scientists are not happy about that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because it takes big money to fund these projects.
Yeah. Well, I know this is all privately funded. This project they're doing.
Okay.
It's
they're
millions
wise.
Of dollars.
They're wise.
Yeah.
Because then it doesn't depend on the vagaries of legislators and the change of political situation.
That's
the idea. That's the idea. Exactly. That's exactly the idea.
But that's at this point right now what we know.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Right. That's what we know now.
First time I saw it, it's kind of like too much for my mind right now.
Well, you let it sink in slowly and mull it over. That's what you have to do.
And with that in context, you know, like, I don't know, a long time ago you were saying something like that. For example, like, I know that you know more about this than I do right now. That I need to do a lot more research than to make it. So when someone you speak, pretty much I absorb it. You know, like I don't have to trust, you know, your
Yeah, well, that's stuff. Trust is a big factor here.
Yeah. So how would you want the students to take right now, I feel very sick to take
stuff. Hold what I said. And keep testing. That's the safest position I can
find. Keep testing. How about teaching another younger student? It's an aspect. You could do it. You pretty much.
Well, if you have really severe questions, I wouldn't teach it. But if you have severe questions, I would stop.
If we
I'd try to look into the questions, too. While I was holding back on the questions and see if I could get any
A
tentative acceptance of ideas doesn't mean that you quickly go off and teach them to somewhere else. Although, it is a big issue.
I don't know if you got me a
boy.
Like, for example, you did the lecture, you know, four lectures to the students. When you present me this much, you're saying that this is what I contribute to me.
And a lot of students were very excited, and some of the faculty were very upset.
Here?
Because...
Yeah.
No, not here, where I presented the lectures originally. And they had originally contracted with me to publish the lectures as part of their artist series. And they had contracted. And then I got a letter a while later saying
thank you,
I could have that back, that they didn't want to publish those. So it was back in my hands, those lectures. So I could do with them what I please. Yeah, that's interesting.
I have just two friends, I have a friend who was in my church, and she was coming. And I'm like, as I saw this new idea, I'm pretty much accepting it.
Yeah.
You know, but in the sense, like, right now I can't test it out in the class.
Of course.
I'm thinking, what if she's hearing all these things from a professor, and, you know, in her mind, she can't really test it out.
No. She can't test it either.
Like,
the problem is that so much is specialization today that you have to say, how can I really test anything in depth unless I'm in that field? You can't. So what you wind up doing is you have to trust certain people in the field, and you have to say, are they consistent? You have to say, do they show a genuine concern?